Ombuds Show.
Call in live and ask questions.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, you got it. Right, the show's talk is cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti, and today, continuing in my progressive rock tribute, I've got Genesis this week, the band. Yes, they've sold out, but this is a 1990 interview after they sold out, and but I'll do a little rant on the music industry and Genesis. Turn it down just a little bit. I have Eva in here with me. You want to say hello, Eva?
Hi, you guys.
So Eva's going to be doing a show on Thursdays at 3 p.m. on health and mind health and
brain health and healing.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right, and a couple of announcements. We got Jeff Cohen coming in into town, and he's going to be doing a bunch of events with EugenePeaceWorks.org, because after all, this is KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, PeaceWorks Independent Community Radio, also streaming at KEPW.org. So Jeff Cohen, who is an expert on media, on corporate media, the corporate takeover of media. He'll be on Thursday, November 7th, 6:30 p.m., followed by a Q&A at Broadway Metro, 888 Willamette. Tuesday, November 5th, 5 to 8 p.m., at the Oregon Wine Lab. So, and we'll probably have some audio from that coming up here in the future. So, what else? We have a potluck. If you're here in Eugene, if you want to help out at the station or get involved in the station, it's a volunteer potluck here at 454 Willamette, where the station is, 6 to 8 p.m. Monday, November 4th. At 454 Willamette, 6 to 8 p.m. Monday, November 4th is a potluck. All right, so coming up, an interview with Genesis and some Genesis from my favorite period with Steve Hackett. Coming up here on KBW 97.3 Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio, streaming at kpw.org. Okay, this is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ SSD, on KEPW LP 97.3, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. So, here's my rant on Genesis. What this is from 92, right around the election with Ross Perot and the LA riots in LA. And Genesis started out, they were songwriters. They weren't really musicians, but they worked with good musicians. So then the period I liked was with Steve Hackett, who was a very good guitarist, a brilliant 12-string guitarist. And then they kind of went downhill in the 80s. After that, they came out with Phil Collins got a divorce with his wife, so that's when he came out with all that Face Value Duke tour. And so some of that was still pretty good, but and then they also worked with Chester Thompson of the Mothers, from the Mothers, the drummer from Frank Zappa, and Daryl Sturmer, who was, you'll hear about him in this interview. So what this is they started doing stadium shows, and the way I tie this into my show on corporate malfeasance is this is how musicians. Because they can't make money. Originally, you would tour. You would not make money as a musician on the tour, and you would make money selling albums. So as you know, as online streaming came out, and as people were bootlegging their shows and things like that, now they started making money on the shows and not on the album. So that's why you're paying $200 and $300 to go see a stadium show now. I just was reading in Rolling Stone, Taylor Swift and Green Day are all doing, they're all doing stadium shows because that's how they make their money. So luckily the sound quality, Genesis always had a state-of-the-art sound quality and light show. So they were usually the head of the curve in this. And in fact, the Beastie Boys actually used Genesis' sound system because the Beastie Boys has a lot of bass. And you could always depend on when you're at a Genesis show, there would be a wave of bass going through you, even in the smaller venues, there would be a wave of bass going through you because Mike Rutherford, the bass player, plays the bass pedals, and he had the record for the lowest recorded bass note back in the 70s. I'm sure that's been changed by now. So yeah, the bass was always great at a Genesis show, and so that's why Shoko, the Beastie Boys, and other bands used the Genesis sound system. So and then in every show. Every album, actually, up until recently, they would have what was known as the Evil Jam. And what this was all the elements of a Genesis song they would put in this, they would draw from in this song. And so a version of that would turn up on an album. So you could always depend on, even though they'd have all this commercial crap that they would release, because once you hear someone's music in the grocery store Muzak, they're over for me. It's the end. And you know, like Kiss, once you come out with a love song, a love ballad, like Kiss came out with Beth, your band is pretty much sold out and over. So, yeah, once you heard Genesis on the Muzak at the grocery store, it was over. But they would still, like I say, come out with some type of jam during their shows. And then, and plus you're going to hear them talk about the medley. There was always a medley of that they would slap together of their old songs for the old fans. So, and then you'll hear from Chester Thompson and Daryl Sturmer as well. Okay, so here you go, Genesis in 1990.
And actually in the locker room where you can see all the scars on the wall from Leroy Jordan's helmet from the Dallas Cowboys play. And tonight we're in with three of the rather famous Englishmen. We have the members of Genesis, the core of the band, of course, and that is Tony Banks and Mr. Rutherford, as well as Mr. Collins. And you guys are just brilliant in rehearsal. Now, I know one of the things I wanted to ask is we were sitting there watching it, and all my partners, and we're going, how do you get this started from scratch? I mean, you're at this point where you've got this huge regalia all over this, actually filling up one end of this huge stadium, and it's got to be an awful lot of responsibility. Is it 160 people in your crew? Is that true?
We don't know, actually. If you say it's 160 people, I'm sure it's 160 people.
So you don't have details of that?
No. We trust you, though. We trust you.
Well, we've been told that there's 160 people and there's the 42 trailer trucks. Now you're getting interested.
No. Sorry, there must be some mistake.
With that much, with that much gear, that many people, everybody working, and you're saying, let's go to the genesis of this particular tour. And that is when you guys started. Do you rehearse just at home for about 2 weeks? Just the three of you, prior to actually taking this together and putting this huge, huge project together?
Yeah, we kind of start in the in Chiddingfold, which is in a little town just near our studio, Village Hall. It seems a long time ago, actually. They were just us and just the band gear and Darren and Chester, and we just work on the songs, just the music for the first 3 weeks.
For the first three?
Yeah.
And then do you actually get involved as far as the visuals are concerned, or do you leave that to someone else as to how you want this to look?
No, we get very closely involved in it. I mean, we obviously have people who work on designs and things, some of which, we're involved to some extent, and they submit ideas. Once we've got a basic design together, and then when we start doing the lights and the specifics of what's going on the screens, which are involved in this tour for everything, we've been very closely involved in that and deciding what we want, So what you see is sort of is a combination of us with the people we've been working with.
Going back to actually into the 70s, you guys were always in the vanguard of change as far as lighting and staging is concerned. Is that something that you feel is very important for you to do when you're touring, and especially now that this is going to be a stadium tour? How do you approach that? How does that differ from if you're doing arenas?
Well, we actually are doing all stadiums this tour, so therefore we gauge the show to look good in stadiums. Before, we've done a few stadiums, but some arenas, and therefore, you've got to make it work for both, and it's always got to work in arenas, because you can't scale something down and put it in an arena, but you can just put it in a stadium and it won't look quite big enough.
Mm-hmm. How do you project that? Is there any alterations that you as individuals have to make when you're on stage like that, when you're projecting to maybe a person that might be 400 feet away?
Playing very loud.
Yeah. There is a difference, I guess, in projection. We have yet to do a show for 4 or 5 years now, with a stadium audience, so I don't know quite what it's going to feel like. You get a feel, I guess. We've been rehearsing in a very large blimp hangar in Houston, and of course, the last couple of days we've been at the Texas Stadium, so that gives us an idea of what it's going to be like and how small you can look, even smaller than I really am, in fact. But what really fascinates me is why you've got the volume and the EQ on your voice.
I'm sitting here wondering that
and
myself.
And I sound like a Mr. Wimp. In fact, even all three of us sound like real Mr. Wimps, whereas JJ's here going, whoa.
Hello, darling.
Beautiful thing, baby. Luke, the fourth. Yeah. I know, I was...
Well, you were here earlier. You've rehearsed, obviously. You did your sound check. We were busy doing something else.
We'd like to renegotiate, don't
we? Well, you guys, one of the things...
I was English, guys. I sound Wimp.
You appear to be really obviously loose and calm. And like I said, when you sit there, you sit there and you see the thing that impressed me last night. And you know, I've been around a little while, and you walked behind that stage, and I thought, my God, I mean, you know, this is huge. I said, do you feel any pressure to really deliver, knowing you've got this much responsibility going on? I mean, you know, you said, God, we're going to be playing to 56,000 people, you know, and the show must be good.
You're trying to make us nervous or something? You know, when you're up there, you try and sort of, you can't really see everybody until the end of the show anyhow, so you don't sort of look at it that way, I don't think. I mean, every show, I think, in many ways, the most nerve-wracking thing to play is a club, because everything, you've got no kind of echo, so every note you play, everybody hears everything you're doing. In the bigger places, you know, you can get away with the odd note. I know I do.
No, you don't. Because that leads to something, if I've got the time to run into this, is because we were all remarking about, you know, how incredible the sound system is. Because usually you say, oh, they're playing arenas. You go, oh, God, it's going to be all muddy. Yeah. And you can't see. And visually, I mean, your TV set, I mean, your video is better than any television set I've seen. I mean, you guys are clear as a bell, and the sound is just crystal clear. I mean, I don't know how the hell you get that. So, believe me, we could catch any note you might miss, Tony, but you don't miss very many.
They had them all tonight.
We've got Tony Banks and Mike Rutherford and Phil Collins. And when you guys actually decided on your set list and decided to start the show with Land of Confusion, didn't you find it rather ironic, especially here in the United States, that what's happened over this past week, that the song would fit so appropriately?
Actually, the words... fires burning in the street and all that kind of thing, it's actually very appropriate. Mm-hmm. I think about that when we sing it. It is, the last couple of weeks have been very hairy. My family's been in LA doing all that, and just feeling that it was, you know, you never know how big the thing's going to get. I mean, everybody was saying it's bigger than the Watts riots, but it was a bit scary, yeah. And as you say, you know, when you're singing those kind of words and being a singer, you think of those kind of things.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take some calls now. First one from San Antonio, Rudy, who's listening to us at KZEP. Rudy?
Hi, guys.
Hi, Rudy.
Hello.
Being a Texan myself, I was wondering why you decided to come to Texas to do the rehearsal and Texas to start the tour.
Well, we normally start our rehearsals in Dallas because the lighting and sound company, Shoko and Barry Lights, come out of Dallas, so that's our normal rehearsal place for the kind of tour productions. However, this time, doing an outdoor stadium tour, the lighting rig and the system is so very high, we couldn't fit in the building. So we had to go to the Goodyear blimp hangar in Houston, which has got an incredibly high ceiling, and do 2 weeks there and then a week here. So it's normally Texas, but this time it was a Houston start.
Rudy, do you have another question? Because
we were
going to ask that one ourselves.
Maybe you're going to include some old stuff like Carpet Crawlers or Entangled or Ripples, stuff we haven't heard for a while.
Well, we're not going to do the three you mentioned.
We were going to do Carpet Crawlers,
yes,
but I wanted to do it, but the other guys didn't want to do it.
Carpet Crawlers was on the shortlist, and we did rehearse it, and it sounded great, but you can't do everything. We are doing some old songs. Some songs, we're doing a medley of bits and pieces from the mid-70s. And if you want to know what they are, you'll have to come and see us.
Great. And Rudy, thank you so much.
Thank you
very much for your calls and your questions. And in fact, it leads right into something we wanted to know ourselves, and that is, in listening to that medley, and I'll be very honest with you, normally, you know, when you go to see a band, it's been around for a while, and they put out a few hits, and they go into a medley, you go, oh, here comes the obligatory medley. But this one is a mind-blower, and I'm not sitting here just trying to stroke you. You did some segues that were just incredible. We were trying to figure out how difficult is that in working that out? I mean, that must take a bit of time to know exactly, because it's just such a smooth segue as you were making and covering all those bases for all those years.
Well, we tried to pick songs that we hadn't played for a bit. And there are so many choices that there are obviously as many segues. You know, well, what do you do? How do you get from A to B to B to C? But we tried to work on things that that people would have heard. Because obviously, you know, we're playing to big stadiums now, but a lot of people won't have heard the old stuff. I mean, you know, if you're talking about 30,000 people, maybe 5,000 people actually were around at the time and fans of us at the time when we wrote and recorded those songs, and they always make their feelings felt. But and so they appear to be more in number than maybe they are. So you've got to remember that and pick songs that that actually appeal to, on first listening, to most people. Mm-hmm. So we tried to pick songs that were, you know, that were relevant to sort of different periods of the band's history that people might have heard on the radio, as well as maybe some of the fans that go back that far anyway.
And I think we have a fan like that. We've got Leslie from Detroit who's listening to us at WCSX. Leslie?
Yeah, hi.
Hello.
Hello, Leslie.
Hey, Genesis. Good to hear you again, guys. First of all, Tony, I got to say thanks for Still. If you're still Tony Banks, I'm still listening. It's a fantastic
album. Thanks
very
much, Thanks.
Question for you. Robert Fripp once said that arena shows and stadium shows are nothing more than crowd control. And I'd like to know your opinion on that. And how has your attitude towards your audience changed over the past 20 years?
Well, I think, I mean, the answer to the first part about Fripp's comments, I mean, you know, I think things have changed. Technology has advanced probably since he said that. I think, you know, you can get better sounds in these places. I think the sound, and I think the thing about a big stadium show is it's such an event. It's like a celebration, really. It's got more, it's not just a musical event. It is something more than that, I think. And it can be very exciting, I think. I don't know. I mean, we've played both small places and big places, and I'll say that, you know, I mean, I think they both have their merits. They're different kinds of events, and they can be equally exciting in their own ways.
I agree with you on that. I was at Milton Keynes. Can't forget that one.
Oh, sorry about that. You dried off it?
Time. It was a hell of a birthday party, Mike.
Yeah. Was it my birthday?
It was
my birthday, that's right, yes.
Yeah.
What a good memory you have.
Thanks.
Doing a song in the studio, after you've completed the song, do you get a sense of whether the song is going to work well on stage or not? And also, I just want to add this other thing. When you have this plethora of songs when you're making a new album, which obviously you make, folks, they do record more than just what you have on the album, and then they choose from those. Does that go into your decision at all? You know, say if you've got two songs that you like equally, and you only have room for maybe one on the album, would you go with the one that you think that works best live?
No, I think at that stage you don't worry about live. You just worry about what makes the best record. On this album we had a couple of songs, one especially, which was called Shoreline. Mm. On the Shoreline?
Mm. On the Shoreline.
On the Shoreline. Thanks, chaps. Which we all kind of liked, Tony most of all, but we felt it wasn't room for it on the album because it was kind of an area we'd done a little before. And so it was bumped off, but I mean, it's kind of something you could even play live if we went full up already. But I think at that stage, I think live doesn't really come into the way we think.
We've got some questions from the audience. Matthew calling from Rock 100 WDIZ in Orlando, Florida. Matthew?
How's it going, guys?
All right. Not too much. Speak up, Matthew.
Okay, I'll speak up more, okay. Yep. I'm going to be seeing you down in Miami, so I'm counting the days. My question, I have a few of solos from Tony and Michael. I was wondering if they're going to be singing any solos in concert.
No.
But it can be arranged.
No.
I think it's a jolly good idea, and I think that on Driving the Last Spike, I think I'm going to give that one to Tony, and I Can't Dance, I'm going to give it to Mike.
All right.
All right, well, be there to see if we've taken up the challenge.
And he's now not going to come to Miami, I can see. He's just pulled out.
I tend to sort of do all the singing at the moment, and we've actually got the guys doing backup vocals at the moment. Daryl and Tony and Mike are doing the backing vocals, which is the first time we've actually seriously taken backing vocals seriously. There's lots of backing vocals on the new album, and we didn't want to bring anybody else in to do them. That's to say, hire two or three backing vocalists, because we want to keep the band on stage as the five of us. So it's a step forward, but the next big step forward, of course, is getting Chester to do backing vocals, which is what something we're going to be doing on the next tour, I think. Isaac.
We got another call from Peter. He's listening from WHEB in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Peter.
Oh yeah, hi, Phil, Tony, Mike. How you guys doing?
Hi.
Very fine.
Good. Welcome back to the States. Question for you is, what do you guys do after a show to relax or unwind? On a day that you don't perform, what's your typical day like?
Well,
get up, see the wife.
Don't look at me, guys.
See the bank.
Well, actually, on this tour, it's pretty boring because on nearly every day off, we're traveling. our managers, we're doing a slightly shorter tour this time, and our managers crammed in so many dates, there aren't actually
any days off.
There aren't any days off. It's a pity, because, I mean, you know, going around America, we used to, in the early days, see an awful lot of the states as tourists, and I think we all kind of miss that. You know, now we kind of just zoom through and work at a much faster pace, which I miss, because, you know, America's a great place to look at and just be a bit of a tourist.
Very good.
You can't get here soon enough.
So that's getting pretty boring down there, isn't it? Well, we'll be there to liven things up, don't we?
Thank you, Peter. Okay. Peter calling from WHEP in New Hampshire. And they're with us now. We've got all the lads here. And one of the things I wanted to ask really, very quickly is, Darryl and Chester, you guys been with this band since, how many years now? It's past 10. It's probably a good 15 years?
Since 16 for me.
16 for you.
15 for you.
And 14 or 15 for me, since 1978.
Did you guys ever think that when you were first offered the first gig, because usually, like you say, okay, we're going to go out on the road with a particular group, mm-hmm. that you'd actually, 15 years later, still be touring and enjoying? I assume you enjoy touring with these
yeah.
these people.
Yes. Well, say how much you enjoy it.
Well, actually, I came from another group, Jean-Luc Ponty. It was more of a jazz mm-hmm. type group before this. Chester, as you know, is from...
We slowed you down.
And they slowed us down. No. I mean, in fact, Jean-Luc Ponty played me the Genesis record. I had never heard them before this, before I was with him. And I liked them very much. I heard Trick of the Tail and Wind and Wuthering, and I became a fan right there, never thinking I'd play with the group.
Was that must have been a hell of an experience that first time out, because Jean-Luc Ponty, of course, a famous jazz musician, yeah. but going out on the road with a major rock band, yeah, must have been an experience.
I thought the first gig was very interesting. I don't remember exactly where we played, but it was about 12,000-seat hall, and I was only used to maybe 3,000 at the biggest, mm-hmm. and it was great. It was a great experience, and it was exciting at the same time.
Chester, your background as well, prior to the prior to Genesis.
No, let's not talk about that.
I played with Zappa for a couple of years, and played with Weather Report as well. And, I mean, I freelanced a bunch of stuff over uh-huh. the years.
Mainly jazz bands?
No, quite a mixture. Well, I guess Zappa wasn't really...
No, Zappa not, but I mean Weather Report and such.
Yeah, Weather Report. I mean, over the years I've done a bit of everything. I mean, that's what I like to do is a little everything. I thought this would be good for a couple of tours, you know.
he just sat in with my group.
Yeah, that's true.
He did.
Really?
Yeah, I used to stop in Milwaukee at this club. He used to play in all the time and sit in with...
So actually you and Darryl had played prior to playing yeah. Genesis.
Yes, we did.
That's amazing. Did you think, Chester, that you'd have problems with Phil? I mean, because Phil being a drummer and all, and you're going out on the road with a guy that was a drummer, and he's going to listen a little closer, I would tend to think.
Chester's still having problems with me. Let's be honest. I feel so sorry for Chester. You can answer it in a minute, Chester, but I do feel sorry for him, because we make the albums, the three of us, and we take the songs on the road, and mm-hmm. we start rehearsing them. And, you know, I watch the drum parts like a hawk, and I feel terrible, you know, that I have to, you know, watch everything. And I feel sorry for Jesse, because I kind of, you know, once we get on the road, it's different, but in the early rehearsal stages, it's...
he watches the drum parts. He doesn't listen to them. No, he watches.
Yeah. Yeah. Once we're on the road, I can't get fired. It's too late, then I'll play anything I want. So.
When you guys, I said to say it was a drum solo, but actually it's a drum duo. When you guys start working together, that synchronicity is really there. Does it take a long time for that to come together, or is it just something that you've been playing together so long now that you've just got it?
It's always taken about an hour, I think.
I think it's, each time we do it, we sit in a hotel room, and we play on a chair. We take three chairs. He sits on one, I sit on the other, and we play on the middle one. And we record it, and we literally, this one we're doing now, we played for 20 minutes and recorded it and picked the best bits out of it, strung them together, Chester wrote them down so we could remember them. And then we put it together, and now we're starting to play it. And, you know, obviously it's going to start stretching. Sorry, guys.
We can just have another beer.
But it does come together quite quickly, actually, and that's because we've known each other for such a long time, and we know the kind of things we don't want to do. We've done them, so we just put them aside and say, let's try and do something with two guys playing together rather than trying to play against each other, which is, in the early days, I guess that's what you did. You did four bars each, but now we're trying to play things together, and I think that's kind of more exciting for us.
And as long as you guys have actually been playing together, it must be a lot easier for you to do so. Daryl, it's almost the same question with you and Mike. Mm-hmm. You know, when you go off in those beautiful, long, soaring solos, you know, I'm wondering if you think Mike might be listening a little closer than the rest of the boys.
Yeah, he's trying to learn something.
And, well, Tony as well.
he's trying to learn something.
Thank you, friend.
He's listening more than we are.
Yes. I'm not even in the monitors.
We got a call from Boston, Massachusetts, my old hometown. John calling from Boston, listening to us from WZLX. John?
How you guys doing?
All right.
Good to talk to Chester and Daryl. I consider you guys as much a part of Genesis as the Englishmen there.
Thanks.
I was wondering what the possibility
of getting another live album
out of this tour is. We just heard Three Sides Live and Seconds Out. Apart from there, we gonna get something recorded out of this?
Funnily enough, actually, we're talking about doing a live album after this. If you want us to, we'll do it.
I would definitely look forward to it.
That's
the
deal.
It's a possibility.
Yeah.
And don't mean to hog in it, but if you're going to do that, you should really put that medley in there. Because it's just... John, when you see them do that medley, listen up, because it's just stupendous. It's one of the best
I've
ever
seen. So put the medley in, but not the drum solo. I get it, right. No problem. Definitely.
All right. We also have a call from Frank, who's listening to us in Davenport, Iowa, and 97X. Frank?
Hi, guys.
Hi, Frank.
Hi. My question is to you, are any of you at all nervous at the thought of being on a world tour after it's been so long since your last one?
I think we're all nervous to some extent. I think you're always nervous when you start something like this. I don't think it's, you know, if you're not nervous, then I don't think you deliver, really. So I think it's an important thing to be that way. And I think, well, speaking for myself, anyhow.
No, I think it's true. There's a Dame Edith Evans, who's a very famous English actress, who once said... There was a girl who was in a play with her, and she, Dame Edith Evans said, "Are you nervous, my dear?" And she said, "Oh, no, I'm not nervous." And Dame Edith said, "Well, don't worry, that'll come." And I think it's actually true, because if you're not nervous, you don't have the edge. And if, you know, you need that edge every night when you go on, you've got to remember that, you know, it's not going to go, it might not go smoothly, and you've got to convince people that are there that night that it's going to be good. You know, you can't say to people, "It was great last night, you should have been here." It's got to be, you've got to have the edge every night. So I think it's true. I think we've all been out doing different things. Mike's been out with the Mechanics, I've been out with my band, and I know Darren Chester did gigs as well. So, I mean, it's not like we haven't played in front of an audience, but it is, it's an awful lot of people and an awful lot of high expectations. So, of course, you're going to be a little bit nervous about it. Mm-hmm. Confident, but nervous.
Do you find it a little more intimidating to play, like, say, stadiums as to opposed to playing a small theater or a small club?
Well, I think that there's...
I mean, sometimes when you're playing a club, you're looking right into the person's eyes.
That can be more intimidating, you know, when you know that everybody can hear everything you're doing. As Tony was saying, look, everything you're doing, and look at exactly how you look like. Oh, he's a lot shorter than he looks on television, or, you know, whatever. And I think that kind of thing can be... You're farther away from people in the stadium, so although there's more people, it can be a different kind of atmosphere.
But do any of you miss the intimacy of playing in a smaller venue?
Sometimes. When I'm off, I play smaller clubs, so I do miss that, and it's nice to get back to it. But even when we have a small audience for the rehearsals, sometimes you get a little nervous for that, because it's starting to make you think, a real audience is here, and that's what's coming.
Texas. I love to say, I've always loved to say Texas, because it's just sexy. Dallas, Texas.
Texas. A good audience tonight, actually. I mean, it's very strange. You play in a sort of place that holds 50,000 people, and you've got like 50 mm-hmm. people, and they weren't at the front, and it was the first applause we've had actually this tour, and it was interesting because you actually do try that a lot harder. So thank mm-hmm. you.
So actually, you really won't know until Friday night if you're
still got a job or not.
No, I'm sitting here thinking, you got about 56,000 people are going to be here, and then that's when you...
Well, you're trying to make me nervous again, aren't you? Yeah.
I said that, and Tony went, but that'll be...
We've told him we're playing a club.
And then you'll find out if your placement as far as, you know, because you're all sitting back going, oh, this works, but then you may have to make some changes, huh? Yeah. I mean, you really don't know.
I think we'll probably keep Tony. Phil might go.
Is it difficult deciding what you're going to drop? Because when you've got you know, when you've got a repertoire like you guys have got, I love that word, when you've got a repertoire like that,
Texas.
Is it difficult to decide, well, no, we're not going to play this on this particular, we're not going to do, like, say, Abacab or something, you know, we'll do another number, you know, and how do you decide that anyway?
Well, I think with some of these older songs, we just do, that they needed to be put out to pasture. Abacab being an example of that. I mean, it's a song we like a lot and everything, but we've played it ever since we recorded it. We thought it was maybe time to give it a rest, and that applied to some of the old medley. That's why we changed to a new medley, because the old medley songs, like In the Cage and stuff, it was time, definitely time they rested. And one or two others as well. And also, we've got to fit in all this new stuff. You know, we've got some new material if you want to play.
And it fits in quite well, doesn't it? I mean, that must have been difficult, actually, in line with that question, is to find out which ones from
the
new
songs,
album.
Well, the songs on the new album that actually we dropped for the first time tonight, I mean, Living Forever, we've been doing up until tonight.
I know, that bothered me too. Anyway, mm-hmm. I like that a lot.
Yeah, you know, Tell Me Why, we rehearsed in England, and, you know, Our Way of the World. You know,
the fans are giving away their tickets already.
But we may play them.
We may play them.
No, and you know, you can't play everything, and especially with the advent now of CDs, when you can actually put more music on an album, mm-hmm. then you've got more of a problem when you come to do it live, because you've got more music to choose from than even you had before. So there are songs that that maybe we'll bring in, take out, which we'll chop and change around a bit, maybe.
And do you have, like, you take those kind of options, don't you, when it comes to, like, say, encores, things like that, you know, maybe even just to sometimes please yourselves, you know, if you've been doing a certain, you know, number for some time, then you go, like, you know, 50th date into the tour, it's like, all right, lads, let's go a different direction. What do you think?
We don't tend to change it very much, I think. Just
thank you, Doug.
To be honest, I mean, you know, yeah. Whatever you may think. No. But the encores are certain kind of numbers that work, mm-hmm. and certain numbers that don't. And we're doing the two that work. That's
nice. J.J. Jackson with you at the Texas Stadium here at the Genesis Soundcheck. One of the things we wanted to make sure we got asked. All right, okay, gentlemen, you can turn Genesis down. I wanted to make sure we got this asked of Chester as well as Daryl. And that is, as many years as you've been touring with these guys, there must be some story that you held inside for years, or no one's bothered to ask. You know, what's the most bizarre thing that's happened to you out on tour with them?
Ask Chester that one.
Daryl's going, I like my paycheck.
I like my job.
I think the strangest thing for me was actually the very beginning. I was playing with these guys, and I mean, they were really British in those days. You know, they
British.
Yeah,
British. They were.
You were quite British in those days. Anyway. We'd get through these things in rehearsal, and you know, I was really knocked out. I'd only heard like a really little bit of the music before, you know, started really doing it. And we'd play something, and at the end I said, man, it was really bad, you know. And they would never say anything, you know. And that happened like several times. It was like two tours later that I found out, when one of them finally said, you know, we really thought you were going to quit the band, because you kept saying how everything was bad, and we didn't, you know, we thought you really didn't like it.
That's funny. Daryl, you?
Well, I don't have a particular story, but Chester and I used to always talk about just the different ways of saying things, and he actually made me a little paranoid when I joined the band. He says, you know, they don't tell you if you're any good or not. They just let you play it, and if you're not playing it well, they will say something. But I never heard anything. I used to think Tony Banks hated me because...
Oh, yeah,
he does. He probably does. Yeah. You know. And I don't know if it's the guitar player keyboard syndrome that you tend to go through with bands, but the first time that I realized he didn't hate me was when we had a few beers, and I think it was Hamburg or something. I said, this guy's okay. But I mean, other than that, it's a very...
You mean he paid?
He paid.
No,
he signed it to my rule.
Definitely.
And I knew he liked me. But no, not in particular. It's a fairly straight group. I mean, one thing is when sometimes an interviewer would ask, like, does it ever happen when you trash your room like you did in the old days? And actually, in this group, it's your children trash the rooms. You know, that's it. It's not the band. It's a very straight group.
Put the rappers back on the soap.
Yes. I walk into Mike Rutherford's room, and there's just like, you know, it's just like a cyclone hit it. But it's from his kids, if they're on the roof.
That's after I've tidied up, actually.
Is it make it easier, especially at this stage in the game, as long as you guys have been touring, to take your families along with you, or at least at certain portions of the tour? Does it make it a little bit easier on your cerebellum?
I think it's imperative, you know. I mean, it's we've all got families, and we all want to, you know, see them. And that's, I mean, one of the reasons why the tour is a little bit shorter, maybe, is because Tony and Mike's kids, for example. Well, in fact, and now we're involving Chester and Darryl. I mean, we've all got kids that are school age. I've got a 19-year-old, and
who's left school?
Who's left school? Who's now got a job? You know, so that's the,
she hasn't told you.
Yeah, she's got a job. But I mean, yeah, we've all got kids that are at school age. So therefore, if you're away from home too long, you know, you just miss them, and you miss part of their growing up. So I think that it makes a change. You know,
we've always made a point of bringing people. I mean, wives and people. On the
even,
road.
Even if the wives couldn't come. In. Well, you did, sorry, okay. You did let it open, okay. Over to you, Tony.
Your wife isn't here now, is she? But
I can't follow
people
that
up. That is.
Tony just turned maroon. Anyway, we've got some calls coming in. Martin in Ottawa, Canada. Martin, are listening to us in 54 Rock. Martin?
Hi, Genesis, how are you?
All right.
Good.
All right.
Good. I was wondering, when Genesis is planning a tour, do Mike and Phil and Tony get together and pick the set and then call Chester and Darryl up and say, well, guys, start practicing these, or are Darryl and Chester involved in picking the musical set as well?
Well, we shortlisted the three of us, definitely. I mean, you know, we give a rough idea of the sort of ones we're thinking of, and then when we all get together, we do sort of knock it down a bit, and, you know, I mean, between us, I mean, you know, if they're not keen on playing a song, there's not much point playing it, really. So we drop that one, you know.
I mean, the first thing, I guess, we compile a DAT or a cassette or whatever of the new album and the probable selection of songs from previous tours that we may, and some of the old songs, you know, that might make up a medley. You know, so we go back to the original version so that we don't lose track of maybe how they originally started, because, you know, over the years, you can really deviate from the way they originally thought. Sometimes it's better for that, sometimes it's not as good. So we always try and... There's always the last tour, which you can reflect upon, but we always put on the original root versions, especially with this tour, because it has been such a long time since we did some of these songs, that to try and get the original spirit of the thing. But we're all kind of involved, yeah, we've all got to play it, so...
Thank you, Martin. That's Martin in Ottawa. Now let's go to Wells. Wells from Utica, New York, listening to us at 96.9 WOUR. Wells?
How you doing, guys?
All right.
Just wanted to ask you, on David Bowie's last tour, he had an arrangement where fans could call in and choose the songs that he was going to play on tour, basically a people's choice sort of thing. I was wondering if you guys ever considered doing that or would consider doing that on a future tour.
We have enough trouble agreeing what we're going to play.
Without playing David Bowie songs, I think.
Never actually crossed our mind. I can't see it working because I think, you know, you've got to... agree us with us like anyway, and
I don't know, it's an interesting idea though.
We can't remember all the songs though, to be honest. I mean, there's a lot of songs to remember, and when we decide to do a song on the road that we haven't done for a while, it's just a matter of sort of going back and listening to it and remember what you actually did at the time, you know. And I mean, that may sound strange to people, but we've done a lot of songs over the years, and some of the earlier albums in particular I don't think we may not have listened to for 10 years, you know. So it does take time to relearn them, and I don't think we could do it.
Yeah, I think he was actually announcing, wasn't he, that it's the last time he was doing any old material. Yeah.
Yes.
So that probably makes sense of why he wanted to play whatever the fans wanted to play. And, you know, I mean, it's impossible to sort of to throw some of the songs. I mean, we've been going for 20-odd years now. So to throw the ball in sort of the middle of the room and just say, okay, you know, let's play this, would scare the life out of us, because I mean, we haven't actually heard some of those songs since we've recorded them in some instances, but obviously for not long, you know, a long time since.
I hope that answers your question, Wells. And we've got Tammy calling. Tammy from Houston, Texas, listening to us at 101 KLOL. Houston, Tammy?
Yes. Hello, everyone in Genesis. How are all of you?
Hi, it's
good.
Hi.
Tammy, you got a question?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Phil, I wanted to ask you, tell you that I won a drum from you in November of 88 on the Thanksgiving holidays on a 104 radio station, and you autographed it for me. Do you remember?
Yes.
Candy from Guy?
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's me.
Tammy, you're doing a Wayne's World on us here.
Okay.
You know, did you remember? So, what's the question, Tam?
Which song of Genesis to you was the most emotional?
This is me you're asking now. Which song is the most emotional? Well, without slowing the whole thing down here, well, I don't know, you know, I mean, there was, when I did Face Value, which was a lot of emotional songs on Face Value, and I played the guys a selection of those songs to see if we as a band wanted to record any of them, and Tony and Mike chose Please Don't Ask, which was a song that I wrote for my family, which was on this point of separation. And so I guess out of the Genesis songs, personally, that particular song has more emotional content than a lot of other songs, although, you know, and most of the lyrics I've written since I started writing songs, which was around that period, I kind of feel very sort of strongly associated with. So I think any of them, but I guess if you had to pinpoint one, then Please Don't Ask, which very rarely gets played anyway. I mean, people overlook it because it's, you know, that's not one of the songs from that album that got a lot of airplay. And Duchess, Turn It On Again, and things like that got a lot of airplay. But I think Please Don't Ask is one of the most personal ones.
Do you still stay connected? When you've sung a song 100 times, when you, or in fact, all of you, even though you're not singing, when you're playing a song, do you still stay emotionally connected to the song? Not just musically, not just going through the numbers, that, you know, as, you know, accomplished musicians that you all are, but just emotionally coming forth with it. I mean, I felt that like last night and this evening a couple of times in this set, but I could be wrong. I'm, you know, maybe it's just affecting me that way, but if you're delivering it that way.
Well, I think, you know, at the moment, anyway, I mean, it's very new for us at the moment. You know, we're going on stage and actually, you know, we're not going through the motions yet at all. And hopefully, before the end of this tour, we'll still be going, you know, and feeling it, because it's not a long tour. It's when you've done it for 10 months or a year, then I'm sure that things, you have to go on automatic pilot without noticing.
We'll return and wrap up our Genesis Soundcheck broadcast with Tony, Phil, Mike.
KEPW, KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.